A Sense of Place, a documentary series which looks at regions and regionalism in the state of Minnesota. Produced by Minnesota Educational Radio under a grant from the Minnesota Humanities Commission. Program number one in the series, Anishinaabe means original people.
Well, I guess where it came from, that's, according to Ojibways, at least, it's kind of, if I can use an old historical term that I remember, it's kind of lost in the mists of antiquity, I guess, in some ways. But certainly, Anishinaabe is a term of some importance, because most Indian people that I'm familiar with had some kind of a name that they call themselves. And then when there was white contact, the whites, either because they couldn't say it or they couldn't say it well, the name became changed somewhat, you see. For instance, Navajos and many of the Athabascan-speaking people, like the Navajos and some of the people in parts of Canada, they tended to use the term Diné, which is usually spelled now D-I-N-E-H or D-I-N-E. It's a little mark over the I. And this simply means the people, with an emphasis on the, you see. And I suppose Anishinaabe fits into that same general category, meaning something like original people, or original man, or spontaneous man.
Anishinaabe, an ancient and new name that increasing numbers of Indian people of the Chippewa or Ojibwe tribe are calling themselves. And while it does not strictly apply to all of the original people in the state of Minnesota, it is, in a symbolic way, meaningful to all. Who were they? Who are they now? While this program does not pretend to be comprehensive, it will explore some aspects of Indian life, both historically and in the here and now. Participants in the program are Bob Paulus of the Indian Studies Department at the University of Minnesota Duluth, Don Savage, who was raised on the Cloquet Indian Reservation and whose profession is TV radio news, Don Bebo, coordinator of Indian work for the American Lutheran Church and the Minnesota Council of Churches on the Leech Lake Reservation, and Conrad Balfour, former Minnesota State Commissioner of Human Rights.
For the lies that were spoken, for the blood that we have spilled, for the treaties that were broken, for the leaders you have still. 'Cause to die for your sins, 'cause to die for your sins. Now a new day must begin, 'cause to die.
Is the land good for farming? No, it's not. Is it good for timber? Well, at one time there were stands of virgin timber on our lands, but these have been logged off. Usually reservation areas were established in areas where no one else wanted to live, where 150 years ago, almost 200 years ago, federal powers that be or the state powers thought that, well, we'll send these Indians off around a couple of swamps and bogs and a few lakes with a few fish in there because no one will ever want to go up there. And in the late 19th century, this was considered a very liberal plan. The alternative to the reservation system was liquidation or annihilation, or what we euphemistically call genocide.
For your sins, for the tribes you terminated, for the myths you keep alive, for the land confiscated for a freedom you deprive. Cursed to die for your sins. Cursed to die for your sins. Now a new day must begin. Now a new day must begin.
The fact that we have seven reservations in Minnesota, plus four Sioux communities in southern Minnesota, is not to congratulate any government bureaucrats or any Minnesota state leaders. It speaks more of the tenaciousness of our ancestors in clinging to our tribal lands. Because the plan in Minnesota at one time was that White Earth Reservation would be the final resting place for all Indians in Minnesota. This did not happen, not because legislators, politicians, government officials, the clergy didn't want this to happen. It didn't happen because Indians refused to go, refused to move, refused to give up the tribal lands.
When our land was being stolen, you just stood by. When we were being massacred, you didn't even cry. When they put us on a reservation, you didn't lose any sleep. When we were starving half to death, you had enough to eat. Go down me where...
It's like so many other things that happen in our world. Some small incident, it really isn't small to the people that were concerned, but some incident that was sort of a byproduct of it all just triggered it all off. It was up in Acton, about four Dakota Indians had a shooting match, a target game, and turned their guns on the whites they were having a target game with. They dashed some of their eggs to the ground. They called it the egg incident in Acton. And they were so frightened for the terrible deed that they performed, and some of them had been drinking, that they fled back down to the reservation, which is along the Minnesota River, and told one of their chiefs there that, you know, we're in great trouble. We've just killed five people. Well, other things had happened in the past, for instance, when a cow was missing, somebody from the Caucasian race would take it out on six or seven of the red men. Something else would be missing in a village, and they'd take it out on a whole tribe of Indians. And they knew now that this very drastic act of killing people, that there was no chance for all the Indians, innocent as well as the guilty. And so they decided to strike, and they did. And it ended up with about almost 1,000 whites being killed over a period of just weeks. Started in August and really ended in January. I said weeks, but the last couple of months were just chases by Colonel Sibley, one of the governors here. So we had a terrible war in Minnesota. It was the prelude to everything that ever happened in American history out in the Western Plains. On Friday morning, 10 a.m., 1862, a scaffold plummeted to the earth, killing 38 Great Sioux. The day before, the countryside had mourned the death of Christ the Jew, then went to bed to rise again and crucify the captive Sioux. There were 300 due to die, this the governor clearly knew, but he washed his hands of the grim affair and said, "Abe Lincoln, it's up to you." When Lincoln paired to 38, the screaming Roman sent up Hugh. "We don't want only 38, we want 300 wicked Sioux." The 25th was a silent night. The pastor's chant, "Christ died for you. Now in his name we send to death the souls of 38 Great Sioux." There was Makuwaiwa, Hotaninku, Washikun, and Dowensa. There was Baptiste Campbell, Napiskin, Mayabumdu, and Ashaga. Tip of the horn, one who stands clothed, wind comes home, rattling runner, and one who walks clothed in an owl's tail, tinkling walker, and little thunder. All waited for drummer Major Brown to give the signal for patient death. Then Captain Dooley cut the rope, and 38 were cleared of breath. On Christmas Day, the children laughed, and churches prayed his blessing send, and in their cells the 38 heard, "Peace on earth, goodwill to men."
Hey!
from a black man talking, you know, about Indians. Well, looking, maybe that's an interesting place to be, looking at it from the standpoint of another person who doesn't have the Indian heritage. But certainly, the Indian of this country, which is not a vanishing race anymore, has so much to gain through the romance that we, you know, put upon them. It's very romantic to think about Indians, or to say, I have Indian blood. No one ever says, hey, I've got black blood. If they, you know, this isn't a very neat thing to admit. But to say you have Indian blood is kind of neat.
Where were you when I needed you to bend? And now you claim to be part Sioux or Cherokee. But where were you when we came close to the end? When we had no voice, you never said a word. When we cried out to you never even heard. When our freedom was being denied, you never questioned why. When we needed help somehow, the well was always dry. So tell me, where were you when we needed you, our friend? Where were you when we needed you to bend? And now you claim to be part Sioux or Cherokee, but where were you when we came close to the end?
Well, you know, I kind of think that the Indian people, if they had the choice, would not even live in town. I honestly believe that. At least I wouldn't. Maybe I shouldn't say all Indian people, but I mean, if you have any kind of a feeling for environment or anything at all like that, once you get out in the woods, it's kind of hard to say if you're a Chippewa Indian to want to live in a town. I mean, if you have Chippewa Indian blood in you, it's damn difficult to sit down and to run around.
When I was a young man going off to college, Indian people, you know, said to me, well, if you're successful at this college thing, probably you're going to find happiness and success only if you stay off of the reservation, because we have nothing to offer for you. See, it was a helpful thing. They were trying to help me. We have really nothing to offer a person who has a college education. Nowadays, this has changed somewhat, and I see more and more Indian students, particularly here, who are saying, you know, I want to get this so I can go back to the reservation and be of service. And I think that, again, is a healthy step.
If you're an urban Indian and you're committed to working and solving the problems of urban Indians, that's one thing. I happen to live on this reservation. This is where my people live. This is where I live and have lived for several years. And I think part of it's a matter of commitment, one's own personal commitment to where he finds himself. Also, I feel that this is the land of our fathers. These are the acreage that's left is what we have from our historical past. In a very deep sense, this is where our cultural ties are. So from a kind of a historical, traditional point of view, this is the homeland. This is the home. And people on reservations have always been in one stage or another of survival, defending the land, defending the resources, defending the children, defending themselves. And it hasn't been until very recently that we've been able to assume the offensive and begin to do creative, constructive things with our natural resources and with our own people. And I think in the long run, it makes sense to me, and it makes sense to many other people, that my efforts, at least, will go into the building up and the establishment of our reservations as a realistic and viable alternative to anything that urban areas can offer. I think that when we build something on the reservation, it's ours, and it will be inherited by our children, and it will be for the people for as long as it's there.
Going back
back to the land I love. Going back where skies are big above me. Back to the land I left behind. Back to the pride that I must find. Leave me alone. Can't you see I'm going home?
Going back to that physical and psychological place where Indian people can be themselves, can live within their own traditions, create their own definitions. Back home to Don Bebo is the village of Ball Club, Minnesota, and the Leech Lake Indian Reservation. Asked about the elements of his life, the things that make up his sense of place, Don Bebo will tell you with warmth about such matters as tribal leadership and Indian lifestyle, about growing up in poverty, and the rich vein of humor that is woven into the fabric of his people's heritage.
We've had enough rhetoric. What we need today is the performance. And so, over the years, Indian people, we tend to pay very close attention to the men and women who are considered our leaders. And most of us have worked on various programs and have an idea of how they should function, and we're not functioning, and when they are not functioning according to rules and regulations and guidelines, well, this is what makes some changes during election time. That our tribal leadership, it's very complex. I don't think that there's anyone that understands the full story. But it's a combination of having the confidence of the people in you. This might be the confidence of the people in your people, in your family, in your kinship, plus the public demonstration of your ability to perform and to get results. And this doesn't happen in a few months or in a few years. It generally takes the better part of a lifetime before Indian people will show some respect in you, or will at least respect you enough to vote for you. And when you have the votes of a people, and by some people this isn't understood, but when the people elect you, they're really placing a considerable burden on you to satisfy the needs and the demands and requests of Indian people is... You know, Moses would have a little difficulty doing all this. These are brothers, cousins, aunts and uncles, friends that you've known all your life or that have known you. And if you lose the election, well, the other party doesn't give you a job, some comfortable place out of the public eye. You pretty much have to go back in the woods and cut pulp or drive truck or pump gas or find another job someplace if you lose. You might have to do that even while you're in office, too.
Going back to find the man I am. Going back to find my past and maybe peace of mind at last. Leave me alone. Can't you see I'm going home?
Well, this brush country of northern Minnesota is where I was born. And for many years, for those of us who were born in the classic tar paper shack, this was not something that we told people about. This was not a conversation piece. Though many of us remember what it feels like to be raised, born and raised in a Indian home. There's something about one's origin. When you're an Indian, this has a deep significance. Your identification with Indian people, with the reservation, with the tribe, or with your own clan. You don't ever quite get over this. I can see where Indian children born in urban areas may not have the the same emotional attachment to the forests, certain lakes where you've trapped or fished or hunted or riced. This happens to you at a very early age, and when it has happened to you, I don't know if you ever really get over it. And this is why I think that a lot of urban Indians, also why they feel more comfortable back here when they come, say, for ricing or for hunting, and really feel that if developments continue to improve on the reservation, they might be able to see their way back. Because there is a very strong attachment to the land, to the people.
Going back to where the truth began. Going back to find the man I am. Going back to find my past and maybe peace of mind at last. Leave me alone. Can't you see I'm going home?
What happens today, and I've done this myself and I see other Indian people doing it, is that it's possible to almost live in an entire Indian world, even though, like in Minnesota, we're less than 1% of the population. And what we do is go from, say, if we leave the reservation, we go to Indian people who are our friends, and that's where we stay. And we meet their friends, who are invariably Indian people. And it seems like all other people are outside your world unless they are somebody that you officially have to talk to, fill out a form, or get a job from, or whatever. When you're home on the reservation, you tend to stay close to your own kin, your own family. It's not that you don't go to other communities or to other areas of the reservation, but you just tend to stay close to home. For emotional reasons, this is where you're born, these are your people. My father still lives in my village. Cousins by the dozens all over the place, aunts and uncles. And these are the people that that we feel most comfortable with. And they know us frontwards and backwards. There's no fooling these, you know, our own people. Indian people, you know, just like any other people, thrive on gossip. We tell stories about each other. We bring news back. When somebody does something good or bad, everybody knows about it. And this personal history is stored up in a lot of people's minds, and we know each other. So in a sense, there's no reason to assume or presume that we are something that we're not. We're pretty equal when we live on the reservation. Stories every now and then are rather humorous. A couple of winters ago, logging was pretty good. There were a lot of contracts, and so one guy gets a new pickup. And we all know that he didn't pay cash for it, that he had to sign his life away for it, you know, with some finance company. And after a while, you see a couple of other families, three or four other guys decided they want to get a new pickup too. So you see, all of a sudden, you know, when times economically are pretty good, a couple of new pickups around, or several new pickups around. Then when time gets tough, you know, these cars have a tendency to disappear one by one, and we're all back again driving a brand new 53 pickup, or a third, fourth hand 55 Ford or something like that. So it both reflects, you know, kind of what's happening economically in a community, and also some of the, well, if that guy gets a new pickup, I guess I can get a new pickup, whether I can afford it or not, and enjoy it for a while, and then if things get kind of close, well, then you've got to let it go.
Going back, and there I'm gonna stay. Going back, try and find the way. Mm-hmm.
song to the land that made me strong. Leave me alone. Can't you see I'm going home?
Also, when somebody hasn't seen a person for, it could be a period of weeks, months, years, you'd expect to have a lot of old small talk about where they've been or what they've been doing. But often it'll happen where maybe that individual and the other person were talking about something when he had left, whenever it was, months, years ago. That Indian might pick up that same conversation without saying hello or where you been, or batting an eye, just say, you know, do you still think that that Inger rice paddle is still better than a ball club rice paddle, you know, or stuff like that, and pick it up from there, and kind of incidentally find out everything that's been going on. It's humor isn't so much a part of me. Uniquely, it's a part of us as a people. And, those of us who have known each other for over the years, and a lot of us have been called upon to speak and make presentations, we tend to listen to each other. And what we talk about afterwards is how many goof-ups we've made, how many words we've mispronounced, how many kind of facts we got garbled. Things like Cass County is the most racist state in Minnesota. Little blurbs like that. One time in Virginia, I was at the college, I said, talking about treaties, and I said something to the effect that these treaties are for as long as the grass shall flow and the river shall grow. And I wasn't aware of it until I saw some Indians out there holding their guts and rolling around on the floor. So we tend to make fun of each other, and quite often the hardships of life and the realities can only be stood or borne within the context of a sense of humor. And I think until you get to humor, you're not really being objective about some things. You're being too uptight. And when we can... Usually, many situations are not very humorous when you're experiencing them, when you're in them. Like coming off a rice field, if your canoe tips over, you're not very funny at that point, but, you know, other people look at you and they make sure that there's nothing, you're not drowning or anything like that, and then they generally have a good laugh at your expense. So the humor has always been there. It really has its place in the whole society, among the old and among the young. And it's a very warm, encompassing sort of feeling, a sense of belonging, a very real sense of belonging and acceptance.
Music from Songs of the Sioux on the Canyon label and the album Custer Died for Your Sins by Floyd Westerman, a Perception recording. Special thanks to Conrad Balfour for reading his poem. A Sense of Place was written and produced by Claudia Daly for Minnesota Educational Radio under a grant from the Minnesota Humanities Commission. Engineering by David Felland.
We left Norway on a coast steamer and went to a place called Hamburg in Germany, and then we crossed Germany by rail to Bremen. And when we got to Bremen, our boat was loaded. We couldn't get on there. So we had to stay in a hotel there one whole week waiting for a different boat. A lot of immigrants came by sailboat. We were fortunate. We had a steamer. The sailboats would take several months sometimes across the ocean. They got bad winds, you know. I remember especially one time, everybody lurched to one side of the boat, and we were afraid of going to tip. We thought a man had gone overboard, but they were all excited over a school of porpoises that were playing around the boat. It was crowded, yeah, a lot of immigrants. We had a very small space, and we had to eat in our rooms, you know. In the earlier days before that, everybody had to bring their own food along, but we were fortunate they furnished food on the boat. We'd been on the ocean for a couple of weeks, and we just a whole month coming here, and my brother was 2.5, and I was 4.5. And we hadn't had a drink of milk during the whole trip, so we each stood with a cup in our hand, waiting for Mother to strain fresh milk into our cups. I can still taste that warm milk, how good it tasted.
A Sense of Place, a documentary series which looks at regions and regionalism in the state of Minnesota. Produced by Minnesota Educational Radio under a grant from the Minnesota Humanities Commission. This program is called Prairie People, River Folk, and Denizens of the Big Lake Region. How good it tasted. The milk, the freedom, the new world of opportunity. And how rugged they must have been, those pioneer people, that after 90 years, some are still alive to tell about it. Ole Olson, at 94, lives alone in his home in Fargo, North Dakota. He shares with us his recollections about life on the prairie from the 1880s on. Dr. Hiram Drackey of Baker, Minnesota, is a scholar, professor of history at Concordia College at Moorhead, and author, whose research in the development of frontier farming and the agricultural economy offers special insights about the process by which the great treeless, fertile, stoneless prairie was plowed, planted, and became a prize wheat growing region, whose golden grains are now nourishing millions, here and also in countries across the ocean.
Land was the great opportunity, and the farms were small in the European scenes, and many of these could not make a go of it there, and they wanted to stay in the countryside. I think we all know that there's a natural urge on the part of man to be close to nature.
He was a sailor, and he was the second boy, and the oldest boy had a right to the farm, and he had no way of making a living except sailing, so he didn't like sailing, and he didn't like to serve the king every year so many months in drilling and so forth. So he came here, and then filed on a homestead.
He saw that 160 acres of land promised by the United States government and under the Homestead Act as sort of the pot at the end of the rainbow. He wanted this, and he was prepared to come to the United States and come to the new frontier and take the risk necessary to have a better opportunity.
They came from a mountainous country where I was born. The water splashed up on the windows when the salt water splashed on the windows when the wind was high. So we were right on the ocean and the mountains right up behind us and timber. So it was a great change for them to come to a prairie. They had a song in Norway. Minnesota, Dakota, Nebraska. You had to either go to one of those three places, they thought.
Many of these people were encouraged to come to America by immigration agents who were in the European scene at this time. The Northern Pacific Railroad, which covers this region from Duluth to the Pacific coast along the northern part of the United States, had 1,500 agents alone in Europe. And these agents did a very good job as far as selling the area.
Minnesota poet Rose Muckley in an anthology of Minnesota verse published in 1934, inspired by Largo from Dvorak's New World Symphony. A homeland loneliness descends on him, the Midland pioneer. In alien lands where sweat of autumn days are tears that dim an inner seeing. Weary hulk he stands, backed up against the sky. The sinking sun scoops out a dizzy path behind the furrow. Empire where Mississippi waters run and badgers and coyotes leer and burrow. His night brings homing needs, the spell in things of woman's giving. For him, a new world springs.
We had many bad years. My father was a carpenter, and he managed to work in town and help build buildings and earn a little money that way, or else we'd have been gone like the rest of us. They were moving out with covered wagon day after day.
If they had known, they probably would not have been so eager to come here. We sense this in the fact that by 1890 there were large migrations of people leaving the area, going back to the established areas or going to some other places where they thought would be better, because in a sense the region had been oversold.
Well, I remember father worked in town and he'd walk home 8 miles every Saturday night, and mother used to have a lamp standing in that deep window. He wouldn't get home until about 11 o'clock. I guess he worked till 6 and then had supper, so he 8 mile taken quite a long time. I was always asleep when he came home. But mother always sat up with a lamp in the window, because when they came home, they came across the prairie. There weren't any roads to follow. Just watch for the light and hit for the light.
For some, particularly the women, that single lamp in the window did not shed enough light to ward off the threatening darkness of the prairie. Ole Rolvaag's classic novel, Giants in the Earth, portrays Berit, the sensitive wife of Per Hansa, a woman who never wanted to come to the frontier and who sank deeper and deeper into depression as winter took hold of the region. The days wore on, sunny days, bleak, gloomy days, with cold that congealed all life. There was one who heeded not the light of the day, whether it might be gray or golden. Berit stared at the earthen floor of the hut and saw only night around her. Yes, she faced only darkness. She tried hard, but she could not let in the sun. Ever since she had come out here, a grim conviction had been taking stronger and stronger hold of her. This was her retribution.
It was awful hard for the women folks. Hard to get the right kind of stuff to cook. Try to raise a garden and they'd dry out too, and the grasshoppers ate a lot of it. We had grasshoppers that eat the carrots out of the garden and left a hole in the place where the grass, where the carrot had stood. Mother never liked it there. She just dreamt of Norway every night that she slept. She says she dreamt of running up and down those mountains.
I recorded the story of four women who went the way of mental sickness, died earlier in life than probably they should have if they had not had to go through the burdens. And I can think of some of these. These are names that are prominent in the Red River Valley area even to this day. As one of the sons of one of these ladies said, as I was sitting holding my mother's hand when she died at the age of 55, that she was grist of the frontier's mill. The frontier then, to him, was a grinding sort of situation that took women down another individual pointed out that success here was only possible because of the unpaid labors of women and children.
We lived in a frame house with sod on the roof and sod all around the walls on the outside to kind of protect it from the storms and the prairie fire to come along and burn the weeds off the roof, and we'd come out like the gophers and be all right. The house wouldn't burn with all that sod on it.
What do you think it must have been like living in a one-window sod house?
We had a very small house, about 12 by 14, and Dad made a bed for them, and they put a drawer under the bed. The brother and I pull it out and sleep in that, and when they got a girl, well, they hung a box over the bed, so it was a three-story bed.
One woman in the area south of Fargo made a comment that every time it rained, Mother had to take the clothes and the bedding outside and hang it up to let it dry out, because it wouldn't dry out inside. Another woman made the comment that in 8 years of living in sod houses, the roof only leaked once, and that was during a terrific downpour. The sod house was probably more comfortable in both winter and summer than were the wooden houses.
There really were long winters. There wasn't any skating. There was no ice around where we lived. No hills, so we couldn't ski. Just flat prairie. No trees. We just sat in the house, I guess, and listened to the wind blow.
That these people were dependent upon nature, and they were dependent upon the whims of nature. And no doubt they did a lot of praying. They certainly did some mass praying in Minnesota for the grasshopper plague back in the 70s.
That big blizzard in 1888, 12th day of January, that was a famous blizzard. About 60 people in North and South Dakota lost their way and died. I remember one of our neighbors went out after straw. We all burned straw in the wintertime. He's only 40 rods from the house, and he loaded his straw, and then the snowstorm struck, and he unhitched his horses and let them loose, and he headed for the house, and they headed for the barn. And he never found his way, and next morning the horses were standing by the barn, so if he'd got on their back, he'd have come home. He lay in the field near the house, and the woman had to burn up about all the furniture in the house to try to keep from freezing to death.
There are many stories of fires that went for days on end, took haystacks, took buildings, everything in their way. In areas where there were scattered homesteaders, they had to plow rings around their homestead place. And here is another one of these, I don't know, do we call it apathy, or one of these things that people overlook so much. They knew the danger of the fire. They knew it could get them at any time, and yet they left their fire rings and their fire breaks deteriorate and get grown over again so that the fire would jump them.
We used to have such hot nights there. We'd take a sheet and go out on the lawn and lay down on the lawn and sleep at night outside. It was terrible hot.
They could not have made it without something spiritual to turn to. And it was the spiritual strength that was necessary to pull them through.
Faith in God sustained the prairie dweller, and the knowledge that a gentler world lay not too far to the east. After all, French explorers had begun charting the Minnesota waterways as early as 1618. Trade settlements along the shore of Lake Superior had been ports of call ever since. Minneapolis and St. Paul were burgeoning metropolises, and to the south, cities like Winona on the Mississippi were already centers of commerce and culture. What of these other people, those whose journeys ended on the shores of Minnesota's water highways, whose economic and psychic resources would be forever influenced by the body of water dominating their landscape? In Winona, three academic humanists came together to explore the matter. Paul Graw, assistant professor of English at Winona State College, and brother Raphael Erler, professor of English at St. Mary's College, talk about the historical relationship between rivers and plains.
I think that when you go back in history, you have to realize that there were a lot of things uniting the prairie and the river in this area. You know, we make that border distinction, but I think that the biggest distinction that the people, say, in the 1850s or 1870s felt was that the river area was settled already. It was the older civilization almost, whereas the prairie was this vast, big expanse that nobody was in. So in Ole Rolvag, you find them coming from Fillmore County, which is just down the river here, about 20 miles. Mm-hmm. And Barrett looks back on Fillmore and Houston counties as civilization. And she's so upset by this vast expanse of prairie where she doesn't know what anything is. On the other hand, her husband sees the prairie as this great, big, open kingdom for him to settle, and thought of Houston and Fillmore counties as too populated. You couldn't make a go of it there. Prices were already too high there.
The connection, as Paul is saying, between the river and the prairies, I think, is very close there. Because even when the railroads came, they were up this far, and they debated a long time on whether to run the railroad out, Highway 43 now, or out the way the territorial road went, and eventually went up through Minnesota City and across that way. And the idea was the most economical way to get out to the prairie, because what they wanted was the wheat, the grain shipments. And even as he's saying there with Ole Rolvag, the parallel in Hamlin Garland's father, thought of the prairies, they look across the river at the big bluffs and know the prairies were beyond, and that's what he wanted. And the mother wanted to stay where she was, largely because of his family.
The river was very often settled in this region by Yankees.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was really the first group. Whereas when you read somebody like Ole Rolvag, you have the feeling that the plain was mainly inhabited originally by early first-generation immigrants, mm-hmm. often from northern European countries.
Something like Niantonia, too.
Mm-hmm. Right. It just happened that the river towns got to be very rich, and I think civilization in the terms that mm-hmm. we normally think about it is a matter of having a certain extra to put into it. Now, Winona here was a great lumber town, has a great many millionaires who brought in these people. And we drew our wealth in part from the prairie. If we were the fourth largest grain exporting city in the world, where did we get it? Nobody got rich, I don't think, in Winona simply by working with Winonans. They got rich by taking lumber as far up the Black River as you could get it and floating it down here, and similar things. La Crosse, of course, has the same kind of old aristocracy that we do. And similarly, this wheat trade was taken from straight west of here all the way out to Mankato. One thing that I've heard, and this may or may not have any truth to it, is that right down along the river anyway, one thing that spoiled the woods were the steamboats, which needed fuel, and anything that was near the river was being cleared for that almost continually. And so there's still a lot of places that should have good woodlands that don't.
Of course, that's kind of ironical, too, because Winona grew up because, I think the fellow's name was Orrin Smith, was a captain of one of the river boats, and he left off two fellows. One, his name was Johnson. We have Johnson Street here. He left them off here on the shore to stack up wood, so then when they come back again downriver, they have more fuel. But as you're saying here, they were in raiding the shorelines for the lumber. I suppose you could stretch it a bit and say, well, if they didn't do that, we wouldn't have Winona. There's nobody going to say there.
I think that's almost a metaphor for the whole region. In many senses, people exploited the region, mm-hmm. but without this kind of exploitation on both a massive scale and an individual scale, we wouldn't be here. Mm-hmm. It was just a huge, untamed, very dangerous kind of place to be. And people didn't come out here who weren't sort of desperate, one way or another.
William Goodrow, chairman of the English department at the College of St. Teresa, is a poet whose childhood was spent in New England. He's lived in Winona for 15 years, and only recently has he been able to grapple in his writing with the influence of the river, on himself and on the community. The following are some excerpts from his verse play, Reverie for a River Town.
Here's a lady from an old family, obviously from Winona. My father was born in this town and died in this town, and I'm not going to let just anybody come in here and dictate what goes up and what goes down. I'll probably die in this town, too, but I've been around. I've lived, let me tell you that. These are not jerry-built homes. Just look at them. Go inside. Look at the size of the rooms, the woodwork, the moldings. Look at the high windows, the fine glass, the tiles, the wide stairs, life. Then a girl comes along and says, I have no intention of staying here. I am leaving, Mother. I am leaving for New York City to pursue a career in the dance. And then I have characters coming in saying they're going to leave the town. Then there's an old man. He says, I'm not sad when the river speaks to the old schools and the tumble-down churches. I am not sad when the river steals clean slabs of lumber and sends them to the sandbars and the herons. Or when it remembers how it was when it first thought to carve a valley, and then a deeper valley exposing the limestone ribs of the world to the flicker in the sun. I dream of less than that, and I care for less than that. A man in shirt sleeves says at one point, I wonder if it would be possible on any other evening to look out over the river from my front porch in any other season and see the pearl light spread so evenly on the wide expanse of the Mississippi, and think the sun on the river a heart driving blood through human veins. My old man says another little speech. He says, a river moves in our blood, ferrying bits and pieces of what we will become. It transports the companions of our past, their faces, their shaken voices. It brings us forests of sleep and shells of moonlight. It carries us over the wrinkled skin of the state. It carries us under aisles of elms from the river towns into the heart of the world, where storms and seasons are the passions of love. And then you have these characters. These are types, of course. The banker. You see, if we lower the interest rates on loans for the riverfront property, we are certain to realize a sizable profit in no time at all. And then we hear a voice, male voice, coming and saying, well, just pour it into the river. And then a clergyman, we have gathered here today to pay homage to the river, without which we could not claim our comfort and prosperity. And another voice says, well, just dump it into the river. And the congressman, it is with great humility that I cut this ribbon, which will open an efficient bridge linking us to our sister state at one more point along our common river border. And another male voice says, well, just flush it in the river. And then a female voice says, no, not here, dear. Do it in the river. And this ends with a kind of choral prayer to the river. River, moving without us, take us home. Buoy us outward into the cool, still surface of your flood. Let us read the silver-green dawnings of your mist. Let us number the matte red barns gazing on your changing body. Carry us into growth as you carry crops of apples and corn to gold maturings. Fill us with refreshment as you water cattle and bees. Turn us into your widenings to think beyond our gardens and our streets. Let our minds stretch to touch at once each of your shores. River, let your spring floods drench us with a sense of our first needs. River, teach us to stand up and speak in your lightning voice, in your herds of tumbling clouds, in your merciless summer rains. River of reason, lift us so your moonlight throws meaning on our dreams. Feed us, house us, clothe us with your longing to move beyond our levees, dams, our stone and iron bridges, to reach an April field. Feed us, house us, clothe us with your longing to move among the wings of hawk and teal, to mingle with the highest winds and deepest clouds. River, feed us, house us, clothe us with your longing for the never seen, for the ever-changing, for mystery. River, feed us, house us, clothe us with your longing. And then the girl sings in the background, silently, silently, we let it slide by. taking from ourselves the mirror of the sky.
Another sky mirror, emotion mirror for Minnesotans, is the Big Lake, Lake Superior. Fierce, icy, raging, or calm, inviting, and waiting. How it is how it was. Oh, the type of power used by a Lake Superior boat is frequently a little more sophisticated now than it was in the old days. But essentially, the people who set out in them are pretty much the same.
Well, I can remember one thing I had to do quite a bit of, and that is when some of the larger boats came in that couldn't get into the dock, I'd always have to take the boat out and take the supplies off and roll those into shore. Sometimes I'd have to take fish out to the boat. But more often, I seem that I got the job of taking the supplies in. Some of the, this may seem kind of odd, but some of the things we really look forward to was the tugs and scows used to come in and load gravel. And, you know, there was, the beaches just belonged to everybody. I mean, the owners weren't there to check on it, and so these gravel scows would come in and they might have a piece of pie or something for you or something like that. You know, that was kind of exciting for a kid.
When I was a kid, I had to go out in an open skiff with my father. In those days, he used to use great big rocks for anchor stones, and many a time I was petrified out there, and I think it more or less left a fear of the lake for me. And now the only time that I really care to go on the lake is when it's nice and calm and not too far out.
I went sailing when I was 15 years old. So it was a job then, and I liked it. So I stayed with it. I started on the Great Lakes, and then I went to deep water, ocean, in World War II, and 1946, when the war was over with, I came back on the lakes, and then I subsequently became a master. And in 1959, when the Seaway opened up, I, having had the experience of being out in deep water and having worked with pilots out in, well, all ports of the world that I entered and left, I liked it.
I tell you, the longer you've lived by that lake, the more sensitive you are, you know, about any changes that take place, anything that's going to hurt the lake. You have a much greater sensitivity than somebody just coming in here and you know, they didn't know what the lake was like before, and they don't even know what the lake is like now.
We turned out to be a great help to my father. We were more like boys than girls because we had to go out in the lake and help him set nets and take them in and reel them up and split fish. And when I went to high school, we used to sit up until 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning and fillet fish for him.
That's very familiar to me, and I look at it as my friend, and I always look at it as a challenge too. And once in a while, if you get complacent, the lake will rise up and kick you in the tail too. Keeps you on the ball. You gotta watch your weather, you gotta watch the existing conditions. You gotta constantly be aware that the lake is not totally yours and you share it with other ships. And other ships have a tendency of meeting each other once in a while.
There's always been a certain aura of mystery. Because as much as Americans and Canadians have encircled the lake, there are segments of it which are very sparsely settled today, or segments which have been bypassed. Also, of course, American civilization has used areas and then passed on, leaving these areas to revert. And there is a certain thrill of discovering vestiges of a former civilization.
Maybe I should quote a tourist that came here for many years, and he said something about, you know, he said, that lake, he said, there's just nothing like it in the world. He said, it has mood and grandeur, he said, and it's always changing.
You become attached to clusters of images, to objects, to things, and they become more than what they, you know, objectively are. And a region, a place, becomes, you know, it becomes an inner landscape. It becomes an inner world. That is, as soon as if you can't relate it to the into your own interiority, your own interior life, then it is only a local color. But when it becomes part of a moral landscape or a visionary landscape, then it is what it is, but it transcends itself.
Rose Muckley's poem from an anthology of Minnesota verse, the Times Publishing Company of St. Cloud. Giants in the Earth, published by Harper Brothers. Modern Classics Edition. Music from Dvorak's New World Symphony, the ABC Music Guild series. A Sense of Place was written and produced by Claudia Daly for Minnesota Educational Radio under a grant from the Minnesota Humanities Commission. Engineering by David Felland.